Welcome to Type 40, a Doctor Who podcast here on the Fandom Podcast Network. If you've got the time, we've got the space. It's the show where we take an in-depth and close look at this much-loved TV series, the spin-offs, the merchandise, the entire fandom phenomena. Doctor Who shaped the landscape of fantasy and science fiction for, well, nearly 55 years now. Next month, that's over five decades and counting. Come and step into our TARDIS and share our journey together here on Type 40. Yes, that's a brand new model of the Type 40. We're taking off the forecourt and we're all gathered around the console here today. It still looks a little bit like a work in progress. There's a few voices here on the show today that you may have heard before. So between us, we're going to see if we can suss out these new controls. It's a 3-4 Time Lord job at the best of times. But, my eyesight's not what it was, Kyle. Is that a hologram over there? Can you work it out? Kyle Wagner, esteemed founder of the Fandom Podcast Network. Any ideas what any of this does?
I don't know. You redecorated from the last time I was in here, Dan, but it looks sharp. I like the biscuit producer over here. I was needing a little breakfast this morning.
If you ask me nice, I'll let you have one of those. The button's hidden secretly somewhere about this. You know, I found it, but I'm not going to tell you where it is.
Oh, of course. I see how it is around here.
Yeah, we're getting there. We're definitely getting there. This is the first of our shows where we're going to bring you all our thoughts on the rest of Series 11, two episodes at a time. We're going to keep it pretty fresh, pretty bouncy, as these are they're not our final words on these new adventures. You know, as fans, we're going to watch these things over and over again, aren't we, over the next few years. But, we're going to be here for a good hour. And I think, I don't know if you've had a good chance to look around yet, guys, but Norman C. Lau, have you found the toilets yet?
If I haven't, I thought it was. But maybe that's why the TARDIS is mad at me. I don't know. All I've seen, all I know is that it kind of looks like Krypton. It kind of doesn't. But you know what? I like it.
Yeah. A little bit icy. Well, if we've got it wrong, we can jettison the rooms and start over, can't we? That's the beauty of the TARDIS. Nothing can really go wrong, particularly as we've got two of the founders of the Fandom Podcast Network in today. I'm going to ask one of these founders, I'm going to ask Kyle to remind us of all those places you can, past, present and future episodes of Type 40s. He does it so expertly. Refresh our memories, please, boss. Where can we find everything?
Absolutely, because I found the biscuit button too, so now it's all mine. But of course, you can find not only Type 40, but all the great shows of the Fandom Podcast Network. And it starts with our FPNet master feed on our homepage, fpnet.podbean.com. If you're using a mobile device, you can also use the Podbean app. Just search Fandom Podcast Network. Of course, we're also on iTunes, Stitcher, and if for you Android device users out there, you can always find us on Google Play. Again, just search Fandom Podcast Network. If you want to find us on Instagram, you can search Fandom Podcast Network or Type 40 Doctor Who, and that's TYPE40DRWHO. And of course, our Facebook page, Type 40, a Doctor Who fandom. Just give us a search there as well. You'll find links to it in the show notes as also. And if you want to contact us directly, you can always email us. Again, it's type40doctorwho@gmail.com. On Twitter, it's @type40doctorwho. Again, that's TYPE40DRWHO. And it's the same on Instagram, @type40doctorwho. Of course, I'm Kyle. You can find me on Twitter @AKyleW or on Instagram @AKyleFandom. Dan, where can people find you on social media these days?
These days, I'm still the same places. I'm on Instagram, Dan Hadley, _. I've been telling people _, but it's a double. That's how I'm sort of getting to grips with this sort of thing. So I'm on Instagram, but I'm on Facebook. I'm in the Type 40 Fandom Podcast Network group, chatting away to all you guys, all our co-hosts and our friends and listeners there. So, yeah, as the series is going on, we're talking about every episode there on a weekly basis. So, yeah, come and have your say. Come and ask us our opinions if you wish. And, come tell us what you think of the show. Other than that, also on Facebook, come and search for the Space Book if your taste stretch to other science fiction, fantasy, comics and any kind of geeky activity you can name, look for the Space Book. You'll find plenty of other fans of the same hanging out there.
Sounds good. And of course, Norman, where can we find you as you travel the dimensions of time and space?
Well, you can find me on both Twitter and Instagram at ZocaloCast. That's ZocaloCast. ZocaloCast.
So, and of course, too, if you're looking for swag, the holidays are coming up. You know, you need something to wear when you're supporting new TARDIS. Of course, you can visit the Fandom Podcast Network's homepage on TeePublic and find not only great t-shirts, but mugs, hats, maybe jackets. You never know. They are always popping up new things on there. They've got iPhone cases, laptop cases, a bit of everything. Again, just visit teepublic.com and search Fandom Podcast Network. And of course, reviews. We love to know how we're doing. And one of our favorite places to get reviews is iTunes. So please hop onto iTunes, search Fandom Podcast Network, and drop us a review on any of our great shows. We'd love to hear what you fans are thinking, and we want to make sure we're doing a good job that you enjoy. But with that, Dan, it's time to get into the Type 40 and talk about what were the topics of this week's episode. So I'm going to hand the controls back to you.
Well, I'm glad you reminded me that you mentioned iTunes. And I think before we get really stuck in, we've got a major sort of piece of the puzzle coming back together, didn't we, since we last spoke. That new theme tune and the new opening credits. I'd have to say that I was loving the incidental music as was. I'd heard the composer's SoundCloud samples and things, so I kind of thought I'd love it. It's quite a change from Murray Gold's. Kyle, are you feeling this one?
Yeah, I'm really enjoying it. I think it's a great change up to get, again, as everything is kind of a fresh start with this new season of Doctor Who with our new Doctor, and I really enjoy the music that's in it. It's got a nice modern feel to it, but still pairing very much a tribute to a classic Who sound with that. And I also love that opening segment, though. It can be a little bit eye-popping at times if you're watching it when you're tired.
Really, it comes at you like a magic eye picture used to, does it? Whoa!
Exactly. Yeah. Come into our spell. Yes. Well,
I tell you what reminds me of. The old ink blot test, the Rorschach thing. It looks a little bit like that, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. But there's definitely something old school about it. And I love the fact that that it fades up from black like that. Is that, are you picking up any sort of the old howl around classic vibes from it, Norm?
Yeah, there's a nice refresh to it, but the way I felt about it when I finally saw it, and I think it also it lends well to our anticipation from when we didn't get it, when we saw the Woman Who Fell to Earth. When we saw the opening sequence, first of all, the theme, I like the brevity of it, because I always felt that from, say, Eccleston's to all the way down to the final Capaldi's, I felt that the title sequence was a little overindulgent and overblown, you know, and these giant time tunnels and a lot of these effects and whirling giant names and all that kind of stuff. I felt that it was just overcooked a bit. Now you're kind of making things a little bit smaller, quicker, and you're not spending so much time in the credits like you used to. You know, I personally, my favorite time tunnel has always been 4, but this is a kind of like, feels like a modern 4, you know, with that, like you said, the ink blot, a galactic Rorschach test. You know, and I love the way that the new logo looks. Everything pops right, and everything has like this really modern refresh, and it just, maybe it will become a little bit more ubiquitous as the seasons go on, but for now, it looks special. It looks like everything so far has been well thought out and manicured for this whole new look.
It really makes you feel like you're going somewhere, doesn't it? Like you're going somewhere very, very specific in the way. Yeah, and I do agree with you about the blockbuster sort of the blockbuster nature of recent sequences compared to the Tom Baker stuff. And this one really reminds me of the Hartnell sequence, but also things like the Twilight Zone, where you're going to another place in your, not just on your television screen, but a place in your own self, you know, sort of open to being told these kind of stories in that particular kind of Doctor Who, that magical Doctor Who way. I was expecting the TARDIS to be in there, partly because it was there for the 2005 titles. And as you said, I mean, the Tom Baker sequence, we go into that with the TARDIS. So, yeah, I was surprised that didn't figure somewhere. But you know, I'm not going to complain. It is absolutely beautiful, and they have shortened the time scale of it compared to what it was. That's BBC policy now, that title sequences can only run a certain length. And as the fan of the title sequence, rather than just a title card and a sting, I'd rather have something like that than nothing at all.
So that's a BBC regulated change.
Yeah. They've got we spoke last time about the certain sort of things that they do on BBC America, where they shrink screens down inside title sequences. The BBC do that as well on BBC One, mm-hmm. but with the end credits and the opening credits now, they have a remit that they are not allowed to be above a certain length of so many seconds. I think it's less than a minute. I won't put a figure out there because somebody will tell me I'm wrong. I almost certainly am wrong. But yeah, there is a cap. There is an official cap on it. I'm not sure who decides these things. The original Time Lords up there, wherever they are, maybe. But yeah, at least the theme tune survives. It wouldn't. I enjoy the novelty of the first beak, but it's not Doctor Who without that theme tune. I'd hate to lose it altogether. Yeah, but even if we had lost the TARDIS, I think focusing on the logo, because it is a beautiful logo and it's grown on me. And I suppose considering where the story picks up, they've lost the TARDIS as well, haven't they? When the story picks up, they're hot on the trail of the Artron energy at the start of the Ghost Monument episode 2, and our newly costumed Doctor and three hapless companions are on their way. Yeah, the series at this point, the characters haven't had much time to draw any breath, and you know, it's ironic considering the cliffhanger that we've just come out of. But showrunner Chris Chibnall's first full pure adventure script is pretty lean, just a couple of guest casts, and it's also sandy. I'm still finding traces of it a fortnight later, all over the carpet. We're steaming straight into the action when the story picks up, and our cast, they're separated on two separate spacecrafts, aren't they? Heading for their very first alien world, where there's a holographic marquee, a specific challenge, and some sort of flying fabric offcuts await. It's all a lot nastier than it sounds, isn't it, Norman? Did you sleep okay the following night?
You know, here's the interesting thing about this, and I'm usually a glass half full viewer. You know, when I try and make sure that I'm looking for the positive things that, you know, when I first watch an episode. But the one thing that really kind of didn't strike me right tone-wise, and maybe it's just because I'm older now and maybe because I'm a little cynical, I don't believe in cliffhanger endings when I know that no one's going to suffer the consequences of a cliffhanger ending. From The Woman Who Fell to Earth to The Ghost Monument, we were supposed to believe that our heroes are in jeopardy because the Doctor transported them to where she thought the TARDIS was based on the Artron energy, and then they're out in space, and you're like, oh, what's going to happen? What's going to happen to the nothing's going to happen to them. You know that. You know, so yeah. Why do that? You know, I would have loved it, actually, if they beamed into the different ships, and they're like, oh, what are we doing here? Like, in different ships.
I think, personally, you know this from a creative standpoint, I think it's because it just looks, visually, it's very sudden. They only had 2 seconds to sort of deliver something, to drop a few jaws. It's very, very sudden and visually quite striking to see them suddenly against that backdrop rather than going from one room to another room. And you know what Doctor Who spacecrafts are like. It would probably have looked quite similar to the warehouse. So it would have been sort of click of the fingers and they're somewhere really quite similar. But the other factor is the kids. We were talking a lot about the kids last time. But children watching that,
yeah,
I think it would have blown their little minds just for a moment. And it did. I have to say, it did mine. I'm one of those people who, you know, it'll drop my jaw at first. It'll take me 20 or 30 seconds before I realize that it was complete nonsense.
Well, I kind of guess that's like my point. It's like, it's when I watched it, I'm like, okay, I have to remind myself, like, that scene wasn't for me, right? Yeah. You know, it's like that was meant for a completely different audience. And I am, you know, sort of, kind of a cynic when I see stuff like that, because I don't, when it comes to major cast, when it comes to the people that we've seen signed on and that have been marketed in the posters and stuff like that, it's not like Grace was still with us, right? So, you know, as much as I would love to have been, when I see something like that, I'm like, okay, I know where they're going with this, but it doesn't have any impact, like, for me, you know?
Yeah, I'm still getting over the fact that Norman C. Lewis just described himself as a cynic. I never thought I'd hear you say that. I completely agree. And I think because you sort of, it's that whole thing, isn't it? Of, is this a completely new show or not? And how much of a sort of clean sweep of expectation and of visual language can you have, and how aware are casual audience members of who is signed on for longer than two or three? You know, a great many of them may have suspected that Grace was going to be in the full run, and because Bradley Walsh is so busy over here, you know, and we know very little. We've seen a handful of pictures of the rest of the series. You know, the average audience member was probably, you know, is probably wondering who's going to make it through to the midpoint. I'd never considered it like that. I mean, you said Kyle the last time we spoke that everything was all still cooking, particularly the Doctor. Yes. How did this satisfied your appetite now for a thrilling adventure and a real good look at the new Doctor?
Okay, a couple things. First off, to kind of chime in on what you guys were talking about, the other thing about it is even though we know our characters might not be in peril as far as older viewers go, I think the interesting thing when you have a cliffhanger like that is more of, you're going to think about, okay, how are they going to write themselves out of this? What's the storyline going to be that gets them out of this predicament? I think, you know, it's not so much that you're like, okay, we know these are the major characters, none of them are passing away, but how are they still going to write themselves out of this predicament? I thought that it was kind of cheap in how they maybe did it, and it seemed kind of easy and kind of brushed over initially. But as far as looking at how Jodie did in her second episode, I think she was starting to feel herself a little more as her own Doctor in this episode, and you started to see that. And I'm really, what I'm seeing so far is I'm really kind of liking the mix of what they're doing with Jodie as a Doctor, because you're seeing something that I don't think you quite saw so much with, especially in the Capaldi run towards the end, is that Jodie's Doctor is very much using the science to get out of the problems, and using, you know, really kind of, when you had the scene where Ryan picks up the gun and he's going to basically go Call of Duty, and she's like, the gun's never the answer. The gun is never the answer. And it turns out to kind of backfire on Ryan. And she kind of has a little moment of, I told you so. But what I'm finding is that she has that kind of doctor confidence in herself, but she still feels like she's still feeling herself out a little bit. She's still trying to, you know, figure out everything that's new. And there's been little comments about, oh, I got to get used to being like this, and I got to be used to being like that. And I like that. It's not that they're just jumping right in. It's a slow build. Norman, wanted to interject something.
Yeah, I was talking about this with a couple of Star Trek friends of mine, and I basically made the correlation of Esri Dax to the 13th Doctor. Because we all knew that in Deep Space Nine, the Trill symbiote relationship of Jadzia Dax to, well, Jadzia and then Curzon Dax, you know, that was the relationship that we knew. But now you have all the Daxes, including Jadzia, now into Esri Dax. And when she appeared on the Cisco's restaurant's doorstep, she didn't really know who she was quite as well either. And it was interesting for her to say, like, is that what I would have said to you, Benjamin? And when the Doctor says things like, is that what I would have done? I felt like, yeah, that's a nice kind of nod to all of these voices in her head that she's drawing on while she's trying to figure out her own personality. And I think that Jodie's doing a really good job of being in the mix of that conflict. Like, she wants to trust herself as her new incarnation, but at the same time, she can't discount the fact that she has, what, over, they keep inflating the number, what is she now, over 1,000 years old?
I think it's touching 2,000. And what you just said about when she's being sort of taunted by those rags that are spinning around her, and she says, you know, I've had a dozen lifetimes. It's sort of, you know, come and have a go if you think you're hard enough, that sort of thing. Yeah, I'm going to lay off Jody for a little this week because you know, I wanted to give the listeners a break from all that. But yeah, because I'm still struggling with it in many respects. But that's a more than fair comparison to make between the character and the whole nature of the Trill in the Star Trek universe. And it's and I think that you're absolutely right. This isn't by accident. There's definitely an attempt to sort of fashion the same kind of progression, the same evolution for the character, which to be fair, you know, I haven't necessarily got a problem with. There's some interesting. I don't think Star Trek. I think they barely scraped the surface of it too. So there's a lot of ground that could potentially be covered. They're covered with that in the long term, but in the short term, it's the character and it's sort of tapping into the quintessential Dr. Beats in this first proper adventure, isn't it? Sorry, Colin.
Well, let me ask both of you this because you guys are a lot more familiar with classic than I am. Has there ever been a time after regeneration where they've done a prolonged thing where the Doctor's kind of really struggling after a regeneration kind of dealing with the aspects of the regeneration more than an episode or two,
more than a story or two? No, it's pretty much done and dusted by the end of the opening adventure, wouldn't you say, Norm? I think the Sixth Doctor struggled the most, and there were still the flushes of that into the second story, but not a great deal.
I think that's fair to say, but I also think that you don't really have to kind of belabor the point with. At least when you're dealing with classic, because I think maybe Hartnell to Troughton, maybe a little bit more there, and maybe a little bit more with with Troughton to Pertwee.
I think with Troughton, they deliberately sort of they benched him because that story. I mean, we forget
right.
One adventure sometimes took, in the case of Troughton, the original regeneration, that took 6 weeks to play out in 20-minute chunks. So you know you could say that it took longer if you're a viewer because the character's not formed for a full 6 weeks, or as it would be in the 80s where it was on twice a week, it would be 2 or 3 weeks, or a month in the case of John Pertwee and Tom Baker. So it's funny how times change.
But the thing is that when you say it that way, those were broadcast in much shorter stories. So when you take 4 weeks to tell the Doctor's regeneration story, technically it really is only 2 hours, and in our case it would only be 2 episodes. So it's technically the same amount of time. It's just that it plays out over a longer period of broadcasts, right?
Yeah, and there's a lot more running around and a lot more CGI.
so to go back to what you're saying, Kyle, it's like I don't think that amount of time, if you take the amount of storytelling time minute per minute, was any different. It's just that the formats before were shorter, played over a longer period of releases. So now you're dealing with this, like, you know, is she fully formed in 2 or 3 hours? That's really what you're looking at. And you're just getting those hours, you know, like week after week after week. You know, I guess, you know, your mileage may vary on that opinion with you know, different perspectives.
Yeah.
I felt that she started very, very strong in that second episode in the middle of the crashes. I was quite impressed with the general sort of vibe, but again, between all of them, and the Doctor, as you've both said when we spoke previously, so feels like a component that does fit into that. It's, you know, the problem I have is that I still feel it's a different character. Sorry, Kyle, I interrupted you again there.
Well, no, there was one other point I wanted to make before we started talking about the big points that we had for this episode. Was there was a scene that I think in the scene with the rags, she's talking about all her 12 lives. The rag creatures start talking about something she wants to hear more about. And I think that's kind of maybe one of our first indications of something Gallifreyan that's going to be maybe a part of this ongoing season.
Yeah, they mentioned something that the Timeless Child, and they could see better than she could. That's what they were saying. I can't remember exactly. Yes, it does hint at something of an arc, whether it's just for this season or an arc that's gonna play out over longer. Which I don't know how... I've enjoyed arcs in the past, and I like them in other shows. But I am a little nervous about them playing that up front in the formation with this era of Doctor Who again. I feel that they've kind of done it to death. Particularly Stephen Moffat seemed to have three or four going at the same time. And I think as long as it doesn't sort of wheel too far out of control, that's fine. And again, for some of the little ones who weren't around for previous seasons, you know, if they dash it in here and there, it'll be okay. But yeah, I'm very yeah. The jury's out on that one. Let's see where that goes. Yeah. How are you feeling about the rest of the cast, Kyle? The companions, the friends.
Everything. You know what? They actually have some great chemistry between them. I think it's a great dynamic between the three of them and the Doctor, because what's interesting is here is that they're all taking what's happening to them in this adventure they're on in a totally different perspective, but it's all, each perspective is all one that I think the average person can say, yeah, I can see where somebody would come from this like this or come from this like that. And I think that's a key showing in the writing. And I think complementing that too is really this season and what they're doing as far as the production value of the show itself and how sharp the show looks. And you know what? I think the filming in South Africa and seeing some different locations like that is really helped as well. But I mean, all three of them, Graham, Yaz, and Ryan, Yaz is probably still our most underdeveloped character of the three, but you can feel a connection to all three of them and their relationship with the Doctor, where it doesn't feel like, okay, they know the Doctor is something special, but there's not that superiority of the Doctor over them. And I think that's what's really making it work, because the Doctor is almost treating them like equals in a way.
You know what? I haven't looked at it like that, but you're absolutely right. There is something of a sort of a peer mentality about it. I'm not sure if that's because Graham's in the mix and he's sort of clearly the physically elder. But I think you're right in that the relationships between, not just between each of the other three and the Doctor, but within that dynamic are so different. There's so much ground it could potentially cover over however long we're in their company. In my favourite scene, you mentioned it earlier on, has to be the one where Ryan takes up that rifle and storms out the Call of Duty thing. I'm not a gamer, but I would, you know, my son would absolutely have done that. No, it's the sort of thing you can imagine that people have sat at home watching adventure stories, adventure films and TV, thought, I could do that, I could take those out. And, you know, very quickly he sort of regrets his actions, doesn't he? And the way the Doctor chastises him, it's in a very sort of, very clear and sort of... you know, it's all demonstrated. Everything that she said is sort of played out. Now do you see? Now do you see? It was all very nicely done. And we didn't see a great deal of Yaz yet. But I think as long as when they do turn to those characters, they don't look like they're just standing around waiting for a bus. I think, you know, because on one hand, how in reality, you know, three human beings suddenly find themselves sort of on an alien planet at all, let alone after they've just crash landed, you know, it's fair to say you'd be in a bit of a state. And so you have to take certain dramatic licenses with that to make it interesting and to keep the story moving along. I mean, some of fandom thinks that perhaps already there could be one too many, that it's all been stretched a little bit too far. How you feel about that, Norman? Is it a crowded TARDIS?
It really depends on the ensemble cast, because in this case, there may have been a little large of an ensemble for a second episode and not allowing the viewers to really focus on the developments of the Doctor and the team. So one thing I always liked about the Doctor, even though it's kind of maybe tropish for the Doctor, and maybe this is where the shakeup is for good, is that the Doctor, after regeneration and then moving forward, has always kind of been charmingly condescending to everybody. You know, as he's arguing,
yeah,
like, I've, because I'm, you know, the Doctor's whatever, 700, 800, 900. He always, like I said, that number escalates over series. But the Doctor always knows better. And there's always kind of like an I told you so, like she did with Ryan, but not so condescendingly. So she's more of a team leader now, a team manager of expectations. And we're trying to all find the prism of the point of view of the different characters. I think the only thing so far that I would have liked to have seen in this episode in Ghost Monument would have been a little bit more fish out of water still with the characters. I always feel like maybe too early, and maybe it's because of the brevity of BBC seasons, that everyone accepts the fact that they're here and they're comfortable with that. And I still would like a little bit more fear, I think. If you were transported to an alien planet, I mean, I don't think that I would be nearly as calm as any of these characters. Now, again, that's kind of like trying to manage audience expectation and to get into the thrust of the story. But the only one so far that I really feel like that they're close to being what I think a real reactive character would be Graham. Because he's like, does anyone have a problem with this? You know, everywhere he turns, like, it's kind of like, do you remember you've all seen Galaxy Quest, right?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, so the character that I love the most is Guy Fleegman, because every time they go to a planet, he's like, we're on an alien planet. How do you know you're going to breathe? Is there air? You don't know that.
Yeah.
And that's what I want to see more of these characters do. They're like, they're trusting this stranger implicitly, which doesn't allow the Doctor herself to grow, because it's like, again, I'll lead, you follow. But we're seeing a little bit more personality, but I want to see a little bit more pushback. They're like, why should we follow you? Right? You got us into this stupid mess, and now you're saying that you can't get us out of it? And now we got to cross this desert of death? You've got to go through the fire swamp of the lightning sand and the rodents of unusual size, to quote the Princess Bride. But that's essentially what this is kind of like a forced majeure quest scenario where you have all these different ways of trying to solve a problem. The Doctor's way obviously is going to be best, but I still want to have a little bit more pushback with the characters, because I feel like they haven't earned that relationship yet with the Doctor, or the Doctor with them, because everyone's gelled so quickly. Now that, I think, may be because the characters or the actors are so good at what they're doing that there isn't enough resistance to the relationships to make it feel like the Doctor hasn't earned that level of being the team leader. You know what I'm saying?
As much as that they've been through with grief and things like that, I think that's a fair, I think that's definitely a fair point. And as amusing as all that stuff is, like Graham says, you know, will people stop sticking stuff in me?
Yeah.
And all that sort of thing. You know, love all those moments. And as much as you'd like to think that, I think we've probably all imagined ourselves waking up on an alien world or in some sort of environment like that and thinking we'd keep our cool, or being in the Doctor's company even. In reality, yeah, it would take a while before this person who seems so kooky and hasn't got a mode of transport, and to be fair, and this hasn't got many answers. The trick with the EMP, you know, that seems to sort of win them round quite easily. Which is fair enough, I suppose, when there's a simple solution to a clearly sort of dire problem. Sorry, Kyle, what were you going to say?
Well, you know, this is something I've noticed, at least with the more modern incarnations of the Doctor, is too, that usually the first few episodes, the companions are caught up into the whimsy of the Doctor and the amazingness of what they're seeing, and no matter the dangers they seem to get put in. But there's always that episode, it seems like it's usually around 4 or 5, where they have that moment where they realize, well, this isn't everything that it's cracked up to be. I always go back to the Eccleston run with the episode Dalek, where we kind of really see, Rose really sees the other side of the Doctor for the first time, not just this kind of adventure that she's on with this. So sometimes I think, at least in the more modern Who, they've established that the companions kind of get more wrapped up in the adventurous and the whimsy of what they've gotten into. And then it's like, after a few things, reality sets, something happens that really clicks reality setting in. And I think in this aspect, that's kind of continuing a trend that's been happened at least through the modern Who era.
But yeah, wouldn't I want to counterpoint that. It's like, wouldn't that have been what happened to Grace at the end of The Woman Who Fell to Earth? I mean, for me, I thought that was like, I would have liked to have seen her at least continue on to say maybe this episode where something happened, maybe one of those robots got her, or, you know, it's just, that's where I thought that they accelerated kind of like that moment, Kyle, that you're talking about. You're right. That, I mean, those moments happen. If I were Graham and Ryan, you know, you lost somebody who was the cornerstone of your life. And, you know, it's kind of like, I don't feel like they've grieved long enough for that moment. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. But the one thing I'll just say counterpoint to that is, to what they didn't address in The Woman Who Fell to Earth is because they did have Graham's funeral. So how long a time was it between when she died and the funeral in that aspect? So we kind of missed that area of grieving as well. So, and, you know, it seems like, at least in Graham's case, because of him being a little bit older and having life experience and everything he had been through with her and what she had taught him, he's trying to take the approach he thinks she would have taken.
That's fair. Now, I guess that I get that. I just feel like if you're going to bring three different companions into the mix, I'd like to see three distinct personalities or viewpoints that are a little bit more opposing, because everyone's just like, all, yay, you know, we're in space, and we got stuck in the vacuum of space, and now we're on spaceships, and now we're, you know, trotting across this desert planet. And the only thing that we know is that this person says that she's going to keep us alive. Well, thanks, but that didn't happen like 2 weeks ago. She said that to my grandma, too. And where did that go? You know what I mean?
No,
I mean,
it's a fair point. And I think it's one of those ones that, like you said, I think everybody should have handled it differently. And then I think in this case, what they did was they wrote it as everybody's like, okay, if nothing else, we have to stick with the doctor for survival.
Well, I would have liked to have seen maybe one line where someone says, and it could have been Ryan, because Ryan's younger. You're right. I think that Graham probably would have been like trying to, like, you know, champion on the spirit of Graham. But when Doctor says something like, you know, I'll keep you alive, it's like, well, that's what you said to Grace or Graham. You know, I would have liked to have seen just a little bit of like snarkiness or a bite back saying, you know, to make her earn those lines. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, that makes sense.
Yeah, because at the present, they're sort of treating the Doctor as sort of like a big sister, a bossier, bigger sister, sort of pulling them around into all this, or some like a scout leader or a girl guide leader. And everything that was most interesting, the in between the set pieces that was said, come to think of it, was between Ryan and Graham. The little things like, you know, we're sticking with Graham then, not Grandad. And that, as it's building along, and he just sort of sharply smiles and says, yes, Graham, and things like that. I think when it'll get really interesting is when, at a later date, because even when they got picked up by the two spacecrafts, it was still Ryan with Graham. And when they went to look at the solar panels on the derelict spacecraft, Ryan and Graham were together again. When they take those characters away from one another, in some sort of situation, it'd be very interesting to see how they, you know, particularly Ryan, because he's the one who's sort of almost trying to put the distance there, how both of them react when the other's in danger. There was a couple of really quite strong supporting characters in there, you'd usually say, Epso and Angstrom. How did you feel about them? Do you think they got their time in between all this? Kyle, was that did they stand out at all to you? Have you forgotten about them already?
I mean, they were part of that episode, but it's not anything that they were characters that were part of that episode. They didn't make, I don't think they made a lasting impression on me. Norman, what did you think?
I think that the two of them represented the two personalities that I wanted to get from the companions, from some of the companions. You had the one lady, forget me, listeners, I don't remember their names. I've only seen it once. But you have one contestant, and she was more alongside of the, you know, let's work with the doctor, and let's, because she's done something or said something that makes me instinctively trust her, because now they're going on gut instinct to help us get through this situation. The other one's like, you know what? I don't need anybody. I don't want anybody. This is me. It's on me. I'm going to win. This is what I do. right? The pessimist. You have the optimist and the pessimist, kind of like you have the fire and ice kind of personalities. And you take those two out of the equation, and where is the catalyst for drama with the three companions? And I you know, Dan, you said something that was really interesting, that Ryan and Graham still have a disconnect, and they've been quote unquote family for 3 years.
Yes, 3 years.
Yeah, it was, wasn't it? The marriage was 3 years. Yeah.
So how is it that Ryan still has a level of disconnect, emotional disconnect and respect with Graham for 3 years, but has given the doctor enough agency to follow her lead and then go with what she's saying? You know, I'm like, don't you think that family would stick? I don't know. Like I said, there are things here that just feel like they haven't really matured yet for me. And I think that if you take these two contestants out of the equation, what if they stumbled on that tent? And what if this hologram took them for like, okay, you want to get out of here? You guys got to figure out this problem. And here's your, these are your tracks. And each one of those companions is trying to find a different track. And the doctor's like, well, I think we should do this. And Ryan and Graham like, no, we're going this way. And Yaz would have given her time to develop with the doctor. And it's like, no, I think we're going to go this way. And all of their needs would have converged in the most dire moment. I don't think that you needed those two characters to push you to that point. You already have four characters in the show that are still trying to work together. Why not use them?
Yeah, I was wondering earlier in the week, because I rewatched them both this week, and I couldn't remember their names either. I had to write them down. Inside baseball. Yeah, I had to write them down because I couldn't recall. Art Malik was sort of the guest villain, but to have an actor of that caliber in little more than a cameo role as well as these two. Sean Dooley, who played Epso, you know, he's not a household name here, but people do know him and people like him. He's a very, very watchable actor. And I did consider, could you possibly have had one character who was just more conflicted and sort of slot them in more? Because in my opinion, the whole episode, as much as I appreciated the flavour of it and the direction in particular and some of the scenery, I do think that, as with the opener, that it lost a lot of momentum sort of somewhere in the last third, and slightly underpowered story-wise, whereas a lot of the dialogue was quite nice. If the story's not there to sort of push it along, I was a little bit antsy watching that, and I'd almost forgotten what they were there, or at least what goal the doctor was sighted on, and what's the TARDIS.
Were these stories filmed sequentially, or were they filmed out of order? I don't remember.
I don't know either. I think they may have been filmed out of order. These were filmed in the new year in South Africa. Episodes 2 and 3 were obviously filmed in the same recording block, but it could have, they could have already have got episode 4 may have already have been in the can by this point, would be my guess. Just, you know, because you see the location picture start to turn up, and yeah, I couldn't swear to it, but I suspect you could be right.
I was just curious, because sometimes you feel like when episodes are shot out of order, you can feel that the maturity of certain relationships manifest themselves differently out of sequential order. Like you'll say, like in episode 2, wow, these characters really gelled. Then episode 4, like what happened to the chemistry with all these characters because they were shot out of order?
Yeah. Well, and I think that there's definitely a case for that. It's because of the shooting in South Africa, and they probably shot a lot in Sheffield while they were still in Sheffield, and then went to South Africa and did the shooting that way. So there's no doubt that to me, that these episodes were filmed out of order in that aspect.
Okay, so it's a difficult thing to dial back, I would imagine. You know, I'm not an actor. I don't know. I'm sure they've done it before. But yeah, I can see why. I'm starting to sort of look at this in a slightly different light now. As regards moving the topic on a little bit, so the episode did end with the Doctor's ride getting pimped out inside and out. What are your first reactions on that new console room, the best ship in the universe? We all love it to bits, the TARDIS. What do you think? Kyle, do you fancy a custard cream?
Well, here's what I'm going to say, because Norman, all the U.S. listeners will get this. Exhibit did a great job with the TARDIS and pimping the ride.
Big time.
I love the look of the new TARDIS. I love you, and I think you brought this up on social media, the steampunk kind of feel to it. I think that is a great way to go. We haven't had that look in the TARDIS in a long time. And I like something that they're doing, and we'll address it when we talk about next episode too. I think the TARDIS is going to be actually a very integral character in this season of Doctor Who. I think that's going to play out more when we haven't had that in a little while, where the TARDIS was such a key instrument in a season of Who. So there are seasons where it becomes one. There's seasons where it just kind of is in the background. It's been kind of in the background for a while. I think before it's said and done, because with the new look of this TARDIS and some other things, the TARDIS is going to be a very key part of this season.
I'd say that there's something about it that it obviously it's a very distinctive, creative choice they've made, both calling back through the history of the show, and broadly with the whole crystalline thing. It's sort of I suppose you could say it goes to back to Superman the movie, the Richard Donner stuff, anything that involves sort of crystals at all. There's something, you know, and even when I see crystals, I think of that, and I think of things like Lord of the Rings. I think of fantasy because of how crystals have that kind of romance, to them now. But you've got the 2005 sort of factory settings. There's a definite sort of return to the basic blueprint, at least, of the Russell T. Davies console room for the Christopher Eccleston, David Tennant era, and that it is so much so that can't be. That's got to be a definite choice that they've made. It's sort of like a slight step back before they move forward. Is that can sometimes be the best way with anything creative, can't it, Norm?
Well, I think so. I mean, you know, here's a couple of things that they're doing very smartly. I think one of the first things that allowed the new audience, well, I should say the older audience that's falling into the new Doctor, is when they just briefly used some of the tones of the Murray Gold theme in the first episode, in The Woman Who Fell to Earth, because you felt like, okay, there's a little bit of tonality there. Music plays a very huge part in people's ability to access the nostalgia for certain things. And then also, the palette of the new TARDIS, there are different thematic influences in play. First of all, going all the way back to the original black police box sign, that's a throwback to the original TARDIS. You know, we're not dealing with like the white police, like where it says public police box, and the loss of the St. John's ambulance emblem. You know, that was very much the 11 and 12, right? That was their look.
Yeah. And that, I mean, those accessories were actually there from the original TARDIS, but what you're talking about is a definite reconnection with the 70s, which I think few people, you couldn't really argue that was the heyday of the original show.
Right. And then also what I found interesting is that you're dealing with kind of like the amber brown earth tone hues on the inside. Crystals, from a design standpoint, lend themselves to being both organic and high tech at the same time because of the way that we've been using them throughout the course of science fiction. Data crystals in Babylon 5, crystalline energy, the crystalline entity in The Next Generation. One of the things that I really want to tie back to is when I saw this new TARDIS, it felt very much like bioorganic technology of something that Kyle's very familiar with from his favorite show, Farscape, with Moya being a bioorganic ship, right? So you're dealing with something that is not just technologically a new look, but it's also, I think you're right, Kyle, I think that the TARDIS is in of itself, and if people know their Type 40 history, they are grown. These are ships that are bioorganically grown and then kind of, to use a computer term, slaved to a Time Lord's psyche. You know, which is why if you're not paired correctly with a TARDIS, the TARDIS goes a little haywire. Well, when the Doctor escaped Gallifrey, he stole this TARDIS. That TARDIS wasn't meant for him at the time. So it's never really been synced with the Doctor. And maybe because the Doctor is a woman now, maybe there's going to be a different relationship with the TARDIS. Has everyone really considered that? How is the TARDIS now going to react to a more, say, you always assume that a ship is called she. We always say the Enterprise is a she, you know, or she's my ship. What if that's not a she anymore? You know, what if now, since the Doctor is a she, now the TARDIS maybe is a he?
Yeah, and that goes back to the fact that we have seen the TARDIS as a she before, quite literally.
The Doctor's wife, yeah.
Yeah, the Doctor's wife, which was still one of my all-time favorite episodes. But yeah, I agree with you. And I think I'm going to bring up a point when we talk about Rosa with the TARDIS as well. But yeah, I think it's going to be a very interesting season with the TARDIS, because I think that's something that Chibnall is going to definitely explore at some point, is now that the Doctor has had this gender change, and it, even though it's still the Doctor, there's something different in that DNA now. So how does that affect the things that are around the Doctor, that are long-time things? I think that's an interesting question that could be addressed as the season goes along, as we get into and further seasons.
I can't see the gender making a difference personally, but I do believe that with the clearer deck, that they are, just as both of you sort of picked up on, I do believe they're going to sort of refresh that relationship between those two characters, between the Doctor and the TARDIS, somehow, even if it's just to reaffirm it and to just open it up in a slightly different orientation. I'd like to think so, because every now and again it does need it, yeah. Well, we have our new TARDIS and we've got our new friends. So everything's looking almost like back to normal with Doctor Who now. And it's as good a time as I need to take a break, I think. Aside from discussing the Doctor Who fandom here on Type 40 on the Fandom Podcast Network, there's a wide variety of shows you might also enjoy listening to. Please come back after this little jump to hear our final thoughts on this edition and this episode, The Ghost Monument.
Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying this podcast. We'd like to recommend these other great podcasts on the Fandom Podcast Network. It starts with our flagship show, Culture Clash, our weekly pop culture podcast with the latest news, reviews, and other fun topics in pop culture. Also, Blood of Kings, a Highlander podcast where we discuss all things Highlander. Couch Potato Theater, our podcast celebrating the cult classic and fan favorite movies we don't get off the couch for. Time Warp, a look back on our classic and nostalgic fandoms that we still celebrate today. The End Zone, our podcast talking about all things current in the NFL and giving our best mediocre fantasy football advice. Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. Discoville, a Star Trek Discovery and the Orville podcast. The Hair Metal podcast, if you're a hard rock music fan, the Hair Metal podcast rediscovers the nostalgia of the 1980s hair metal bands. And Type 40, a Doctor Who podcast, as we discuss all things Doctor Who, past and present. You can find these great shows on the Fandom Podcast Master Feed at fpnet.podbean.com. The Fandom Podcast Network is on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, Google Play. On Facebook, you can find us at Fandom Podcast Network. On Instagram, we are at Fandom Podcast Network. And on Twitter, at FanPod Network. You can also email us directly at fandompodcastnetwork@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening and support the Fandom Podcast Network. And remember, respect others and enjoy your fandom.
Yeah, well, it's been a big and high-profile start for this new Doctor's Era and Series 11 of Doctor Who. Please feel free to get in touch with us via Twitter or our Facebook group. We'd love to hear whatever you think. And we'd also like to know if you had your own TARDIS and you had that biscuit dispenser based in the bottom of your console, let us know what kind of biscuits you'd choose in yours. What would you have, Kyle? What would your biscuit of choice there?
Maybe something with a little lemony taste to it, you know. But it might be something where I have it rotated out. You know, we could put out some Jelly Babies one week, a biscuit the next week. You know, it kind of depends on the adventure. Kind of like this episode of Doctor Who, because they covered so many different little dangers as they went through it, and I think it worked really well to for a lot of character development in this. So my treat might be depending on what the adventure was. I think Norman was liking my Jelly Baby idea.
I like the rotating snack bar. You know, why not? I mean, this is the TARDIS. You can have Jelly Babies. You can have custard. Didn't they have a custard dispenser?
On there, yeah, they're talking fish, about the it? Fish sticks and custard dispenser.
The fish sticks and custard dispenser. Wouldn't it be interesting if they had all the snacks from all the different doctors from previous?
Like, that's it. You could just have an assortment. Or I was just thinking you could probably bake Jelly Babies into a biscuit, couldn't you? Into an Oreo or into some sort of cookie. That would be possible. Wouldn't it be a bit chewy when you hit the Jelly Baby? But that would be the sense of adventure, wouldn't it?
Wasn't that the center of a Jammy Dodger?
Near enough. Yeah, but there'd be a randomness, wouldn't it, the Jelly Babies? You'd sort of scatter them here. You'd need a really big one. You'd need a really big face to eat something like that, maybe, and a lot bigger hole. But yeah, I think this is something to, this is something, definitely something to send into Chris Chibnall. Yeah. And if anybody out there's got their ideas of the biscuits they want to see, it's Twitter @Type40. Doctor Who, and let's know your choices, hobnobs, whatever you like. Surprises.
Dan, the TARDIS controls are throwing out some timey-wimey stuff here.
Good.
We were supposed to talk about two episodes this week, but we got a time emergency here. So I think what we're going to have to do is leave on a cliffhanger and come back with a second episode to talk about Rosa. Norm, are you seeing anything on your console?
I'm phasing out of time space myself, so I don't know exactly what's going on. But for some odd reason, I'm seeing a newspaper on the ground, and I think the date says 1955.
What is this? Back to the Future? But you know what? We're gonna get a few things fixed here on this TARDIS. Hey, it's a new TARDIS just out of the oven. We got a little bugs. The TARDIS is telling me, Dan, go ahead and close us out, and we're gonna be back with a part 2 of the Type 40 covering Rosa.
If that's not a cliffhanger, I don't know what is. thank you, Kyle. Thank you, Norman, for your company. On behalf of all of us, thank you for listening, and join us again next time for another thrilling talk-tastic. Biscuit-tastic installment of Type 40, a Doctor Who podcast on the Fandom Podcast Network, where we have the time if you have the space. Bye.